This is Yasa Sagonige,
a 7th grade grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look. OCO, Ginalee, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
Hello everyone, this is Blue Otter, and this is Prophecy Keepers Radio. I'd like to welcome everyone to the show. I'd like to introduce our special guest today. Is Chokosh Aho'o. She is a Chumash Indian elder of Coastal California Indians. And how are you today, Chokosh?
Oh, very well. Thank you, Blue Otter. Nice to talk to you.
It's a real treat to have you. And I guess we had a chat the other night and talked about lots of interesting things. And I thought I'd tell the folks how I found you, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Oh, great. I'd like to know myself.
Well, as you know, I publish a couple of prophecy encyclopedias, one for the Eastern and one for the Western Hemisphere. And from time to time, I do a web search, anything having to do with the Hopi elders. And I guess about a year and a half ago, ran across your name on the internet, because the elders, I guess, had called you back, I guess, about 10 years ago, and had a couple of messages. The most impressive one to me was the 10 points that they gave you, and then the one that I guess Uncle John gave you, which. Yeah, the two of them together make a lot of sense. So, and I guess you knew what John Lanza and his wife. And why don't you go ahead and tell us about those experiences?
Oh, all right. I was not raised in the Indian tradition. My grandfather on my father's side was Chumash and some early California Spanish, and my grandmother German. And the Indian connection was not spoken of, although I was quite dark-skinned. And on my mother's side, her people came out of Mexico in 1922, and they were some Spanish and French, and then Yaqui and Mayo Indian, all coastal people. And I had a feeling, and there were times when my grandmother on my mother's side would kind of make jokes, and at one point she put into my hands, when I was about 16, a blanket, which she said had all of the medicine and the journeys and what it was that her grandmother had learned, and she put it in my arms, but she didn't go into any detail. And they were of, as many other Indian people of my age now know, there were some generations there that were either too afraid to teach their grandchildren or their children Indian ways, or they were ashamed.
Uh-huh.
And, but I had this predilection, this tendency to live in the trees, to take my shoes off, to talk to the earth. And in 1965, I happened to join some Baha'is at a fireside in Tempe, Arizona. And there was a man speaking about the Apache people and about Geronimo. And he had people come up and look at these photographs. And I was so deeply moved. There was a photograph, a large photograph, of Geronimo up close. And his eyes simply glistened and burned. And it was like the whole history of the Indian people and all that they had gone through and their courage and the beauty that would survive no matter what was in his eyes. Well, it was, I probably have never had anything hit me so hard. And I went outside just to be out of the room. Suddenly there was so much noise that I just needed to get quiet. So I went out and I stood under the desert night stars and just began weeping. It was like feeling the waves of what had happened to the native peoples, what had been their experience. And It was, I just began crying. At first I thought it was for myself, and then it felt like it was for all the world and all the generations of all the people because of the terrible ignorance that causes so much pain. When I came back into the building where Philip Cazador was speaking, he looked at me very directly the moment that I entered. And for the next half of the Baha'i Fireside, he's speaking about his people. He never took his eyes off of me. And I felt my whole life at that moment shift. Afterwards, he came up to me and he said, I want to take you to my people. I want you to meet my mother. And I think there was a short visit. It's kind of hard. That goes way back quite a ways. That would have been early 1966, I think. And I ended up, they made a dress for me, and I danced with the people there for 4 days and four nights and during the ceremony. And this was my first real experience with not in the movies Indian. And of course, there's it seems like almost no connection. Shortly after that, and there's a whole story of what happened the 4 days that I was there. Shortly after that, living near the beach, there was a community radio station there called KTFK in Los Angeles, part of the Pacifica radio. And a friend of mine had asked me if I had heard the 5 days of interviewing the Hopi elders, what was called a colloquium. And I said, no, I hadn't heard that. He said, well, you must make this connection. He had come all the way down to the beach to be sure that I knew this was happening. And he ended up taking me to a place in Hollywood where Thomas Banyakya and one of the Hopi elders, David Menantier, were speaking. And there was also a man there who was Chumash. He called himself Semu Huahute. As I sat there and I listened to the elders talk about how the government was attempting to regain, take away all the Hopi land by a terrible system of mortgages. It was a 27-page bill that was kind of being snuck and yet pushed through Congress called the Omnibus Bill or Omnibus Act. So I don't think I spoke to the elders that night, but I went home and tried to write letters, tried to compose a story that could be published exposing this. And I realized that I was making a terrible mistake, that by my trying to help without personal knowledge of the people I was crusading for, that I might do them more harm than good.
Mm.
And with that, I took my two young children who were sleeping in their beds, put them in the back seat of the car, a bunch of laundry that I figured that I could wash somewhere along the way, and started heading out for some place called Hopi. And then I arrived in Flagstaff a day or so later and suddenly became terrified that what did I think I was doing? Who did I think I was? And would they ignore me or laugh at me? And suddenly I was facing the mystique of the native wisdom and my own inadequacies and ended up staying 3 days and three nights in that motel room with my children, just not knowing whether to go forward or go back.
Mm.
And finally, I just decided it was worth the risk. And so as I then drove onto the Hopi reservation, the Hopi land, I won't call it a reservation, I pulled into a place, and I think that I, by that point, had known that it was Haute Villa. And I got the two elders, Thomas Manyakya and David Menangye. I got their names mixed up. And I drove up to a bunch of Hopi kids playing baseball out in the field. And I asked them where Thomas Manangye or David Manyakya was. And they just looked at me and laughed and pointed in the direction of the adobe houses and said, "It's the one with the blue door." And then they giggled and all ran away laughing. So I drove a little further in, and I got out of the car and looked around, and all the Hopi houses had blue doors. And so I just walked up to the one that was directly in front of me, and I really was terrified that I'd be seen as a fraud or an interloper or who knows what. And I knocked on the door, and an old man came to the door. And it began to thunder and lightning, and the rain was began to come down very hard. My children were asleep in the car, and this was a good thing, because then the elder looked up at the sky. He looked at me and invited me in. We sat in front of his pot-bellied stove on two overturned buckets. He offered me a cup of coffee, and the next hours were just lost in storytelling. Wonderful, wonderful things. The time passed like magic. My children stayed asleep, and just about the time he and I came to the end of what we had to say to each other at that moment, then my children came in the door, and I was invited to come and live in Hopi. And David Manangye, one of the fathers of the Kachinas, or grandfathers of the Kachina clan, he and his wife Nora gave my children and myself their bed, and I began to live at Hopi for the next year.
That's an amazing story. Did you meet Tazula Brinkerhoff when you were...
No, the name isn't familiar.
She was a teacher of mine. She was an adopted daughter of David and Nora.
Oh, is that right? They were wonderful people. Wonderful.
And wrote a book during that period of time. And
what year was that?
Well, I want to say she was probably researching it in the 60s. And
I was there through 66 into 67.
Well, I've got the book here in front of me. Yeah, it looks like it was... 71, but I know she was around them earlier than that, because she I remember the stories. Of course, she had met Rolling Thunder earlier, and so I think the relationship probably went back to the mid 60s, and you might just not have run into her, and because I know there's pictures of David and Nora at Zula's house up in Salt Lake. She had been the secretary to the governor of Utah. And,
you know, there was a man named Larry, I don't remember his last name, who we were both going back and forth. He came from someplace else, but, you know, for a while I didn't move out of my other house, and so I was going back and forth. And they thought in Oribe, where David and Mina Lanxa lived. Oh, that was your question, wasn't it? He was a special friend of theirs. So mostly in that beginning time, I was in Hood Villa, living at David and Nora's house. And then I spent time with Femina and Thomas Benyaki at their home, but lots and lots of time sleeping in my station wagon parked in front of Mina and John Monks' house in Oribe. And it was in Oribe that I think most of the knowledge was passed on to me. There were little incidents that happened in Hood Villa, but the lessons came from Oribe.
Yeah, that'd be the center of the culture, definitely. What a story! That's amazing. They
until told it's the oldest continuously inhabited community in the Western Hemisphere.
That's right.
And they have great ties to the ancient Incas and Mayas, Mayans and Toltecs.
Yeah, they have a parrot clan, so you know they had to come from someplace else.
Well, it was there that they told me about the Great Migration. And part of my love is to learn more and to share at whatever level of knowledge I have at the time. These migrations of people fascinate me. And when I lived among the Maori of Aotearoa, they told me about their great migrations, which they call the Hikoi, in their wakas and canoes, and where they came from, and how long ago it was. There's so much we can talk about.
It's amazing. The one of my pet subjects is, of course, the Cherokees. We were told by our leaders in 1750. That we came from across the Eastern Ocean, and archaeologists and ethnologists point out that the only place that you, in the world that you can find dolichocephalic skulls, which are long, thin skulls, other than around the seacoasts worldwide, is up in the Appalachian Mountain chain between Alabama and Pennsylvania, surrounded by other cultures, and of course our language is completely different, so I think and even the name Maori is so close to one of the ancient names of the Phoenicians, which is Mauru, in northern Africa today is Mauritania, Morocco, and I think it's very possible that that the Maori people, you know, may have some ancient connection with those
people.
Well,
let me share with you what Hakama Matu, who was thought by many as king of the Maoris in a village called Paworenga. What he told me, and he was able to recite his whole lineage that went back over 1,000 years.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
And he said that they came from Assyria on great ships, and that but there were times that there was land travel, and he talked about their people being up in Tibet and coming down in through India and going, you know, this different journey, he shows me. And then he said, then we came around the tip of South America, and our people, some of our people stopped and created a community. community in what is known as Easter Island, and they call it Rapa Nui, and they still speak old Maori there, and that's where the Akuaku statues that are built on the cliffs overlooking the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they have a whole thing that they recite about going into Tahiti and Hawaii, and then also I do believe that the Haida people in the Queen Charlotte Islands may be part of that great migration. And then he said, then they finally, their last stop, I believe, was in, you know, and of course they're peeling off in different groups and then colonize those areas. And the last to be colonized was Aotearoa, the land of the long white cloud. And that was also told to me in a mystery school called Manu Ariki. And that's an ancient mystery school. Their genealogy is very, very important to them there.
That's astounding.
You know, before I start telling these people's tales, I did a meditation while I was preparing to talk to you. And trying to think at first, I couldn't imagine. There's so much to talk about, so much to share knowledge with. And I couldn't think of how to begin. There's different parts here. Like there's of course my own personal story, which is still going through its changes. There is just little anecdote stories of people I have met who've been my teachers. There are political aspects to this, and then there are the lessons, what I called in the beginning when I started teaching, I called them 11th hour tools for spiritual activists who are in a hurry, or spiritual warriors in a hurry. And then the Hopi called me back to them in April of 93 and said to me, Chokosh, you've been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go back and tell them that it is the hour and there are things to be considered. So there are the tools, and then there are the sacred stories. And in my meditation, it was all a jumble, and then it came to me that perhaps before I start telling other tribe stories for them, that I should probably do a sage ceremony, and then maybe start with some shorter sacred stories. And then wherever that leads to.
Oh.
Right?
Oh.
I think that that's a value to the people, and that folks that aren't going to be particularly interested in my personal story, but they do want to hear what are the sacred stories, we might as well get them before they lose interest. Okay?
Sounds real good.
Okay. I just feel more comfortable preparing in this way. And so I have before me in abalone white sage, and with the miracle that is fire, I take that element and I take it to this sage, and there comes from this sage smoke, sacred smoke. And many people have seen people just take and waft the smoke over their bodies. But I'm going to do it now in each piece so that people will understand what in fact they are actually doing, and to also ask people to never call it smudging again, because it's a wrong word. This is a plant of purification. This smoke cleans and clears one's spirit, and to smudge means quite the opposite. All right? So here, now with conscious intent, I take this sacred smoke over my head that I may purify my mind to seek truth. And now I take the sacred smoke to purify my eyes so that when truth is before me, I will see it. I take this sacred smoke and I purify my ears so that when another speaks their truth, I will be able to hear it. I take the sacred smoke and I purify my mouth, for it is from this place that the Great Spirit has given me to speak my truth. And I take the sacred smoke and with conscious intent, I purify my heart, for it is in this place we all know the truth. I take the sacred smoke and with conscious intent, I purify my whole being that I may be here in a sacred manner with you all.
Hello. Oh.
Let's start with a petroglyph that I'm looking at here. It's a Shumash petroglyph, and it was sent to me, and I guess it's repeated in many, many areas where the Shumash were, and that was a large, large area. This particular one, I believe, was taken from the Carrizo Plains. But it is also in the mountains of, along the coastal mountains of Santa Barbara down to Topanga. And I call it one of the Shumash creation stories.
Uh-huh.
Let's see if I can describe this petroglyph for you. There are two shapes of figures. They are the same size. They are in a dusty kind of a brick red color, and they are joined together in their arms that are next to each other, and then their outer arms are reaching up to the heavens. There is like a great sunburst of yellow coming from their heads, and at one point it connects those beams of yellow light coming from their heads. They're connected there at the head and the arm. What I see this to be is that there was a time before matter when all was just energy. And there were two sovereign energies that did not come together, and one was the positive, one was the negative. One was the sacred feminine creative energy, and the other one was the sacred masculine creative energy. And until they came together, there was no form, only energy and space. When they came together, each remaining independent and yet joined in thought and in deed, they both became pregnant. And this shows a great blue surrounded by yellow circle in their bellies. Both the sacred feminine creative energy and the sacred masculine creative energy, in joining their thought and deed, both became pregnant. And then from their bodies came these great rains filled with the seeds of all life and form as we know it, and it rained down, creating the earth, and as it soaked into the earth, and then from that earth, all life. It's a beautiful picture, beautiful picture. And you can't tell which is male and which is female. They are the same size. They are equal. They are in perfect balance. They are separate, and yet they have agreed to join together, and that both are pregnant. And I love that story.
That's a wonderful story.
The Maori have a similar story about Papa Tuanuku, who they say is Mother Earth, and Rangotani is with Father Sky. And before there was form, there were just these two great lovers, and they held each other so close, so tightly in their love and in this embrace. Well, there was another god named Maui, came along, much like our coyote figure, and he decided that these two beings needed some space. There was not room for anything else, and so he planted a tree in Papa Tuanuku's belly, and as this tree, the great Totara tree, grew and began to spread its branches and forced a space now between a Rangotani and Papatuanuku. And so that from this longing for each other and the great love in that was now separated, or their embrace, from that then all things grew and came to be.
Oh.
So sometimes in wedding ceremonies I talk about that you can love so much, but there needs to be some space that allows for balance and each one to create as they were made to do.
That's true.
So that's just a petroglyph. When I lived among the Hopi people, they would take me out, particularly John Longson would take me out and explain to me the different sacred places on that particular mesa and what happened in their history and when the Mormons came and took their children and built a church there, and they were warned not to do that, that they were building on a sacred site, and they built anyway, and how it was destroyed by lightning. And as we would walk along the very uneven ground around Oribe, and no matter how careful I was, I found myself tripping and going up and down on this uneven ground. And then I got a funny feeling and noticed that this old man, John Longsa, Mina Longsa's husband, that he was just kind of coasting really smooth, that there wasn't even the motion in his shoulders of someone walking. And I looked down in some amazing way, expecting what I next saw. And what that was what I now call skimming. His feet were moving just above the surface of the earth, like maybe, I'm holding my fingers up, my joint figure, maybe 2 inches, 2.5 inches, right along the earth, and just as smooth as could be. That's happened to me about 3 times.
My
since
word.
Then, and that was around 1966, I guess, toward the end.
Yeah, Handsome Lake reported that same kind of phenomenon with the three that appeared to him.
The Tibetans know it well as well.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, I just call it skimming. It reminds me a little bit, well, I don't know why do I call it skimming. I don't know, maybe like when you toss a flat stone out across the water, and when it moves just above the surface of the water in one of those really good skims.
Huh. I know.
It's quite something. I've never done it on purpose. It's just snuck up on me a couple of times.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. I think those sort of things, that we may have all done them at will, that all of those so-called secrets or miracles were a normal part of our lives at one time on this planet. I think we are really very, very old. They're constantly pushing back the how old they think humans have been here, how old the Earth is, literally billions of years. A lot of things can happen in that time. And the Hopi say it's this is the fourth world, that 3 times before there have been great civilizations with great technology that went out of balance, and when they did that and they affected the balance of Mother Earth, then she washes herself clean. The Hopi say the first time was by fire, and the second time then another civilization eventually grew and took on a great technology that again affected the balance of Mother Earth, and this time the world washed itself clean by ice. And then see, by water, and fire, ice, yes. And then the third world, those survivors, again, through a long, long time, were able to create another great society with a powerful technology that, again, was not in balance with the energy of Mother Earth. She washed herself clean, and this time it was with a great deluge of water. The Hopi say that those that survived, for them, were underground, and that it was then Masao, the great messenger, who reached down with a great ladder and brought the people back out onto the surface of the earth, and took the great truth, the truth that that contains all things great and small, microcosm and macrocosm, the great truth, and divided it into many parts, gave these parts to the people and sent them in the four directions, each bearing a portion of the great truth. And during this time, they were told that they were to look for signs in the sky of when to stop and build and when to move on. And they were to tell this story at every solstice, winter solstice, that it would be remembered. The people needed to know that they had only a portion of the truth, and there were others who traveled with their portion of the sacred truth in the other direction. But this migration took a very long time, and in time there were those who forgot the old stories, who began to think that they had the only truth or the most important piece of the truth. And then when they thought of that, then the sacred hoop of the nations was broken, and they began to make a religion from their piece of truth. They built walls around it and doors that shut out the truth of others. Once the great hoop of the nations was broken, then they began to fill that vacuum, that space, with the technology. And in time, like the other three worlds, that technology went out of balance and began to affect the balance of Mother Earth.
We'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Hi, this is Will Bluehour speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony. So it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
And that's where we are now. And the Hopi warned us that David Menangi said that if unchecked, that we would take it to its inevitable course, and we would create a gourd of ashes that would fall from the sky, and destroying all life as we knew it, boil the oceans. And then they also said that there would come at this time another technology, and that would be the technology of communication. That if one, and I've seen the petroglyphs there on the rock between the cliff between Oraibi and Dagotsmuri, it shows you're out in space, and how they knew this, and that there's this earth, in a perfect sphere, and around the earth, they said, would be shimmering spider webs in which the people of the four directions could communicate with one another, and that if they did this in a sacred manner, that and they spoke their truth in a sacred manner, and they listened to each other in a sacred manner, then this would mend those fragments of truth, and the truth would be known, and in doing that, the sacred hoop of the nations would be mended, and we would survive into the fifth world. And
that's amazing, because each employee during his orientation at Cherokee Nation headquarters is told that the elders in the 1950s said that someday the world would be surrounded by a spider web.
Yeah.
And look,
world wide web.
That's right. The Sioux people, Ed McGaw, when we interviewed him a few weeks ago, he said that that this would be the time of communication, and then if it was used for good, it could be used to bring people together.
Exactly.
It's absolutely amazing the parallels that one can discover when you start to look at all these prophecies, and that's why I do it, because it's just so fascinating.
Yes, well, when I was very young, I was in my, about my mid-20s, when I spent that time in Oraibi and Hoodzilla and Opendu Oraibi. And at that time, because I had not been raised in this tradition, I didn't know what to do with this knowledge. And it seemed like, in a way, I was finally being spoken truth to, but in my, say, 25 years of life, I had swallowed so much garbage, so many social lies and untruths and patronizing things, that it was like I was already full with so much junk that every time they gave me a truth, there would be this huge burst of enlightenment, and then this, soon after, followed by this moment, really hard moment of indigestion, where I would have to go in deep and kick out all kinds of cultural untruths. And that's the thing, is that we just need to empty out and open up, because this is the time of communication, time where we should listen to everyone. I had a teacher once who said, "You're all young." He said, "Be like sponges. Just take it all in. Listen to it all. Ask people their stories. Find out how it is for the people of the earth and different cultures and things. Take it all in. And those truths will connect like dots together. And all the rest will just fall out by its own weight." And so, you know, don't stop the flow by being suspicious or judging. Just witness it. Look at it. You know, and right now I call it the time for connecting the dots. We've all been gathering information for a long time. And we're sacred beings. We can do this.
Reminds me of Uncle John's advice to everyone. He said that everyone needs to lose the word struggle from their vocabulary. He said there's a river flowing very fast, which is oddly like what Edgar Casey said. And he said that not to fight the current, just to get out in the middle and go with it.
Let me give you his words exactly. Uncle John the Iroquois Elder says, "We must know that there is a river flowing now very fast. It is so swift and so great that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel as though they're being torn apart." Uncle John says that this river has its destination, that all that we are asked to do is to push off from the shore into the middle of that river, keep our eyes open and our head above water, and I say, celebrate. See who you find in that river with you at this time, and celebrate. And that's when Uncle John then added, because he said, oh, you're adding something to my story, are you? And I said, yes, we need to celebrate. He said, that's good, because this is an important time. He says, there are many people who have gotten that they're addicted to struggle. And he said, you'll never get off the wheel that way. And so what we want to do at this time, so we don't burn out, is just take the word, the whole concept, struggle, just pick it right out, get rid of it, flush it down the toilet, stick it in the ground and walk away, and that we are to go on with our lives and do what we do, but do it with a sense of celebration, and then we will never burn out, and others will be attracted and want to join us in this celebration of getting done what must be done. And you can add that or connect that to every aspect of what it takes to be on the planet right now.
I couldn't help but notice after reading that two or three times that most of the people in the American Indian movement, when they sign off a letter, it says yours in struggle, and then they sign their name. So
there's no chance then for them ever to get beyond that mindset. It just goes round and round. We need to celebrate the life it is that we want to create now. You celebrate it as though it were so, and it is. But in struggle, it's exhausting.
It is, and you're
like
right.
Like the word smudge, I don't think they really need that.
Yeah, smudge sounds something like something that's dirty and black. But I know, a lot of people that...
You're getting hard for me to hear.
Well, I know a lot of folks that were involved in the American Indian movement, and a lot of them get burned out because it's just so hard and so stressful, and you can't see short-term benefits. Progress. It's a long struggle. So I think Uncle John's advice was good advice, just to go with the flow.
But it changes everything, and it gives you some energy to do it. You know, we can only struggle so long. And then, of course, there's the terrible, what do they call it, lateral violence that happens, I understand, with suppressed people, where what is pushing them down seems so huge and out of reach that they begin to be aggressive and violent in spiritual ways to each other. And that's been a terrible problem among the Native American new communities, in that they tear each other down.
They do. Yeah,
instead of supporting.
There's a lot of young people that get involved in that kind of behavior, and it's so self-destructive. By the way, I always have wondered, by any chance, is Uncle John John Fadden?
You know, I don't know. Is John Fadden Iroquois?
Yeah, he John pretty much single-handedly, I guess, he and Jake Swamp and maybe a few other elders, they literally brought the Six Nations back. There was just hardly anything going on culturally. It taught an entire generation, retaught them their, along with Mad Bear Anderson and a few others, retaught them how to govern themselves and got them to be proud again of their culture. His son Ray runs the Six Nations Museum, I believe it's in Onondaga, New York.
Uncle John, and the first couple of times were long phone calls, and then I finally did meet him, and I was able to stay in a place up in Santa Barbara, a gathering of people for about 3 days, and he was there. All that I know is that at the time he was living with his family somewhere near the Kern River. Excuse me. Oops, I'm sitting in front of an open window. Excuse me. So I don't know, but those men, they have done some wonderful, wonderful work, and I just am so grateful that they're there.
Well, it's certainly good. Good words of advice. What did the elders tell you would happen once the migration was completed? Did they talk with you about that?
Yes. That if, in using this technology of the shimmering spider's web, that if we put the emphasis on that and that communication, and then, you know, it's going to be one or the other. If we don't communicate and communicate truth, then that's it. We have now created weapons so terrible that we may look like the planet Mars in, who knows, 10 years. You know, we have that capable, that crazy capability to do that to ourselves. Or if, in fact, we go and put the emphasis on the technology of communication and mend the sacred hoop by honoring each other and listening to each other's truths, then the Hopi say that at that time they will intermarry and that all people will become mixed, that we will truly become one people in honor and respect and in a sacred manner, and that this time we may go from this, the fourth world, into the fifth without that whole terrible destruction, that it's like an evolution, and there will be peace and abundance for all.
So it's up to us, and like they said, the ones that you have been waiting for are you.
Yes, we are the ones we've been waiting for. Yes.
Of course, the flip side of that is, you know, I've met the enemy and they are us.
Yeah, ouch. Yeah, well, it's all a paradox, isn't it, when you get down to it?
Well, yeah, like you, I wasn't raised in the culture, but it really is interesting, because I was brought up, my parents weren't particularly religious, but they believed in spiritual things, and especially had a respect for prophecy, and I just couldn't help growing up, once I started hearing about the native prophecies, I couldn't help notice the similarities, but for a while I thought, oh well, you know, you have no way of knowing, those may just be prophecies that native people had borrowed from Christian people, and that's one of the first assumptions, which is a mistaken assumption that people could make. And then I looked a little bit deeper, like I always do, and realized that the breadth and width and length of these prophecies is so great and so much more voluminous than anything. Even the Tibetans, when they came and met the Hopi, they commented that they were astounded at the prophetic tradition. They said, oh, well, we have lots of prophecies too, but they're written down and stored in the basement, and they said, we'll have to go home and brush them off. But
1973, that was. They've been here a couple of times since then with the Hopi, but that was the big time that it happened, and they met each other. The Hopi were expecting them. They had prophecies that even named the particular color of the sect that would come. And then they went down into the Kivas together and stayed there for, from what I understand, several days. and just were in wonder and joy and very serious and very happy in so many places where they had the same stories and missing pieces for each other. That's how I got to the Maori in New Zealand. I had a radio program in Monterey County for 5 years called Songs for the Earth, Mending the Sacred Hoop. And while I was there, I met two musicians, Daniel Becker Callegos and Pony Vigil, two Native American musicians. And so they wanted to put some music behind the sacred stories that I had been told, the creation, migration, and prophecy stories. So we filled a tape, this was before CD, with about 54 minutes of the Chumash, some of Uncle John's There is a River, and the Hopi stories, and stories about one of the Cherokee elders, the Haniyawaho. And somehow a copy of that tape made it to New Zealand, and I got a letter saying, here is your ticket to Aotearoa. We expect you at this time. We have missing pieces. Oh, you have missing pieces of our stories, and we have some for you.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh,
but
yeah.
By any chance, did you meet Maki Ruka?
Is that Maori?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Maki he's walked west now, but another one of my guests traveled with him quite a bit, and Maki did quite a bit of teaching. And just wonder if you, I guess it was pronounced Maki, actually, Maki Ruka.
Yes.
But he's one of their elders. And
be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of wisefoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfasts and 10 delicious dinner entrees from wisefoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year supply from wisefoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingraham, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why?
Well, isn't that interesting? So you got a invitation to go down there. Isn't that amazing how everything's connected?
Yeah, it certainly isn't, especially now. And one of the things that I was warned, who told me, which of the elders, oh, I think it was Thomas Banyakya, said to me that in the time of the purification, there would be a great polarization, and there was no middle ground. There were the people that were for life and living, and the Maoris would have called them the Tu'iwi, and then there would be those who operated from darkness and only created death. Well, as the Maori calls those people the Pākehā. And here you are. I mean, look at it. You've got our whole government is a death cult, you know, and we've been lied to just severely. It's 1984 and then some. And it's a death cult. That's what they're manufacturing. That's what they're making. And that's what they're not blowing up, they're polluting. And I love my seafood, and I can't just, I having to live like everyone so defensively, because they're literally poisoning the earth. They have no right for that, to do that. And I have grandchildren now, and I think about that.
Yeah,
so here's our polarization time for sure. Have you read the story about the Blanket of Hope? You mentioned a few minutes ago about the Dene prophecies.
Yeah, I've been...
This is one of them, and that blanket actually exists, you know.
Yes, there's a picture of it that I borrowed off of your website, and people can see it at prophecykeepers.com.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And why don't you go ahead and tell us about it?
Well, the website, do you know, is it .org or .com? I forget.
Chakosh.org.
Oh. Well, it has actually its own website. It's www.theblanketofhope.org or .com.
That's right. That's right. You do. It does. It does have its own website.
Yeah.
Let me look it up here.
Okay.
And go ahead. While I'm doing that, go ahead and tell us about.
Well, that blanket was woven by Sonia Begay, and it was brought to me by three Navajo women elders, and that would have been around 1986, I think, maybe early 87, during the protest against making the Nebrosera Franciscan priest, saint. And so it came about that time, and it's a beautiful, magnificent blanket. It's exactly 6 feet long by, 2 feet.
Looks like it's 6 by just a little under 3 feet. It is theblanketofhope.org.
Oh, it is. www.theblanketofhope.org. Well, it's a very, very important story, and it shows the three court maidens. I'll just share with you how the story was told to me. This blanket is a blanket of prophecy, and it shows that the main figures are three court maidens, and they are bearing arrows ascending and descending. These are arrows of truth. And the story of the blanket goes that one day we will find this world in famine and despair, and it is because truth has not been spoken. And if we are to survive, it will be because the truth, the feminine truth that is in every woman and in every man, must step forward, and that if those arrows find their mark, then, oh, and the arrows ascending, descending, to me that means there are truths that will now ascend, and some truths that we have been fooled into thinking were false truths must descend. And he said that if the feminine truth steps forward, And there are truths that descend and other truths that ascend, and if they find their mark, then it shows corn growing on either side of the corn maidens. And that means that the reason why we're in all the trouble that we are, if you get all the way down, this is sort of like the string theory of what's happened to Mother Earth. And that is that we are out of balance. The Creator has made things in symmetry, in balance, so that they work, so they can be in harmony. And there isn't just men. There are men and women. and that there is a male truth and a feminine truth that need to work together. But the feminine truth that men are ashamed of in themselves or afraid to show, and the feminine truth that is in women, which has been suppressed, is like a great bird that was created with two wings to fly. One wing is very strong and the other one is bound. As long as it is like that, this bird is going to go round in circles, knock a lot of things over, create a big mess, and never get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That everything, the truth of everything is the truth of everything. That we must release that other wing so it can balance, and then that bird can take flight. We are in this terrible time of aggression, destruction, one-upmanship, king of the mountain, who's got more. And, you know, this is a very masculine energy, and it is not tempered by the feminine. And it is the feminine who really does mature earlier, is the social one, is loves communication. This needs to balance that masculine. If we were in balance, we wouldn't be spending trillions of dollars on war machines and only few millions on education and health.
Oh.
We need to take care of our people. How can they call themselves, what is it, the first law of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not kill. There's no excuse. It is no more an evolved solution than the caveman's use.
Yeah.
So it's just the worst, the stupidest. So easy to desecrate and destroy. So anyway, that's my big soapbox stand on that, but to me it's so clear. Oh, by the way, I took this blanket with me to New Zealand. And one night I was in one of their meeting houses called a marae, and I was asked to tell the story of the blanket of hope. So I told that story about, oh, by the way, it doesn't promise that the feminine truth will step forward. It says if the feminine truth steps forward and the arrows find their mark. We have to make that choice. It's up to us who are the ones we've been waiting for. So I finished telling the story, and there was a Kauia, elder grandmother, Maori, sitting in the front, and she was all excited, and she was rolling back and forth on her haunches, and she kept pointing at the blanket, and she said, and finally, she just couldn't keep herself still anymore, and she said, the border, you didn't tell them about the border. Well, I had never thought about the border. It's a beautiful border of spirals and steps, sort of.
Looks kind of like waves.
Huh?
Looks kind of like waves.
Yeah. Well, she said, look at our flax leaf wall designs that we have here. And, of course, they were the same thing that you see in the Mayan and Aztec carvings on the temples. And she said, tell them about the border. And I said, well, it's a very nice border, but I don't know what it means. And she said, oh, well, we do. And she hops right up, and she explained the border to me, which is also in the website about it. It shows it. She said, you see, these spirals are the truth of nature. If you want to understand life, you must take off your shoes, she said, and feel the earth, smell the earth, get grounded that way, and know that the laws that govern all of our lives come from our connection to nature. And then she said, and do you see these stairways that are supported by this spiral of the laws of nature? And I said, yes. And she said, well, we call that the staircase to heaven. And I started to panic, and I stopped her right there, not wanting to be disrespectful. But I said, does this come from the missionary teachings? And she said, no, no, no. She said, this is our life. And every one of these steps is an obstacle. And what you do is every time you meet another step, instead of calling it an obstacle, like the word struggle, you just say thank you, and you take that step. And for a while, you rest on that step, and you learn that lesson, and pretty soon there's another step. Just say thank you, and take that step. And she said, if you keep doing that, and that's what we're here for, then eventually you come to this place of peace. And knowledge that you've embodied.
Reminds me of Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War, and I think he mentioned that the word crisis really means opportunity.
Yes, isn't that wonderful? You know, in a sweat lodge, the first time I ever went into a sweat lodge was in 1978 at the occupation of Point Conception, where I received my name in Santa Barbara. And I wore this kind of rayon muumuu dress inside. I didn't have a bathing suit. I don't like that anyway. But so I went in there, and I started to get so hot, and then I just became terrified. It was so dark, so close, so sweaty, and the heat was so intense that it actually melted the back yoke on my dress.
Oh my
word.
So
it really did get that hot, and I was very shamed, but I had to go out after the third round. Then Archie Fire Lane Deer, who was there, said, you must go back in again, and this time you sit with me. And so I sat next to him, and what he told me was this. He said, the heat from the stone people is like the challenges of life. It's your fears, your ego, your attachment and connection to things that are keeping you down and confused. And so he said, what you do is don't lie down on the ground. Don't cover yourself from the heat. But instead, when it comes, lean forward into the heat and with your hands bring it to you. Because like life, when the difficulties come and the fear comes, it's going to happen anyway. So instead of being the victim and just being hit by it, reach into it with your being and bring it to you and say thank you. And then it changes, like our nemesis becomes our ally. He said, you will never be in a sweat lodge or in a situation in your life where the heat is too much for you. He said, oh, a grandmother then added a part to it. She said, it is not the events in our life which cause us the pain. It is our resistance. And so when you remove the resistance and you welcome it to you, it's going to come anyway. You might as well welcome it to you and say thank you. Then there is this instant, and you can feel it in the sweat lodge. Suddenly, it isn't too hot. It's a part of you. There's no resistance. It moves through you. It's a great, this is why I call it teachings for spiritual warriors in a hurry. Because these wonderful spiritual truths, they don't take years and years in a mystery school. They don't take sitting on a pillow forever and, you know, whatever you're supposed to do by that route. The truth is so much there that in a moment you can test it and know that it works. And that these used to be a part of our culture. We all knew this, but we forgot.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that really astounded me when I started walking down this path was when I discovered that the elders said that at this time it would be a time when all of the old beliefs, the lost beliefs, the medicine societies that had died would all begin to come back, that all the truths would be taught through spirit. And then, of course, the counterpart to that from the Eastern Hemisphere in the Bible, it says that this is the time of the restitution of all things spoken of by all the mouths of all the holy prophets. And that kind of thing can really get your attention. And that's the time that we live in. And, you know, my wife and I were just talking about this the other night. I'll be 50 in December. She's your age. She's 61. And I was saying to her, Betty, I said, do you realize that the world that we live in now is completely different? It's almost like a different planet from the world that you grew up in the 50s and I grew up in the 60s. And she says, oh, yes. She says, it's just completely different place. And, it was prophesied. Absolutely amazing, the things that are happening.
Yes, it is. But, you know, we have tools. I used to teach different courses or gatherings, and in this Tools for Spiritual Warriors, the first series was Sacred Breath, and there is so much that is controlled by the breath.
Now, did you say Sacred Breath?
Breath, yes, in breathing.
Well, one of the things that every once in a while Spirit whispers things to me.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
And this would be going back to about 10 years ago. It was about the time that my first wife passed away. Just before she passed away, there were four things that were told me in one night. And one of the things was, remember the sacred breath. So I, you know, the implications of that are, well, it's something I already know, and I have to figure out what it is, and then, the sacred breath, is it breath? Is it the master of life? Who's the sacred breath? Breath is everything. And it's nothing, too. And it's just one of those things that's had me thinking for a long time. It's just like, once or twice a year, Creator will tell me something. And he gave me a prophecy in August of 2000. He said, the three have been trying to come for the past 400 years, but they have been unable to come because the people have not been ready.
We're not breathing right.
Mm-hmm. And he said they are coming in 2004, so get ready.
Did you say the three?
The three.
Oh.
And I got to thinking, you know, that's really interesting. You know, are we talking about Masao and his two helpers? Or are we talking about the three that appeared to Handsome Lake? And, of course,
the
three
corn maidens.
Three corn maidens.
On the blanket.
The three can be seen several times in the Bible, the Book of Mormon. You know, there were the three that appeared to Abraham. So it's a very mystical thing when you start talking about the three and what could happen this year. Of course, Edgar Cayce, there's a very little-known prophecy that Edgar Cayce left concerning 2004, which was just announced not too long ago. He said that in 2004 there would be a new race that would be established. And when you said that we would all intermarry, the first thing I thought when I heard that Edgar Cayce prophecy was, well, that has to be the Rainbow Tribe, the real fulfillment of it, not what we see nowadays, but something that's really true and lasting.
Can I offer you the Shumash creation about the people of the heart?
Please do.
Okay. This was told to me by Grandfather Victor Lopez, and also one of our Shumash people, Kotlota. And it was told to me in 1978 when I was there at Point Conception, and then also later when I was to live with Grandfather Victor Lopez Gallego. And I don't know if this is the whole story intact. I can only give you what it is that was shared with me. And he started off by saying, and I believe he was talking about the Shumash people, I don't know, you can draw your own conclusions, but these were his words. He said, "We are not of this planet. We are star people. We came from the Pleiades, the seven sisters, in silent ships powered by the sun. We came to a great continent of land that was out in the Pacific Ocean. And there we brought a great technology, and it was a technology of the power of the sun through crystals. And with this technology, we were able to move great masses of earth, create great channels or irrigation, and to," he spoke of there being a way of anti-gravity, and also let's see, what else can you say about that? Anti-gravity and the power, lasers, power of the crystal, or the sun, by the crystals. And he said, then there were the people of the mind who were not satisfied with that much power. And what they did was they took the natural crystal, changed its shape. I believe he said it was something from concave to convex or the other way around, but somehow there was some changes done fooling around with those crystals. And when they did that, and they became even more powerful and began to affect the gravity of Mother Earth, and the pole shifted, there was great upheavals and earthquakes, and land masses began to sink, and others were forced upward, and it caused a great schism with the people. And they were divided, became divided into the people of the mind and the people of the heart. And the people of the heart warned the people of the mind that they were no longer in balance. And the kind of technology that they were using was now very dangerous and could destroy the land and the life as we knew it. But the people of the mind figured that they had created this problem and that if they became more powerful, they would be able to set it right. Well, it didn't work. And our land began over a period of time to disappear into the ocean, out in the Pacific Ocean. And I'm told that there were those of us who were the memorizers. And over a period of time only, I think that we might have been aquatic to begin with, but became the dolphins. And they went into the ocean to survive and to remember these stories about what had happened to us. And the land disappeared. Some people say that there was a great rainbow bridge that connected the sinking continent to the west coast here. And there were those who survived by coming that way. Now, some say that the dolphins became the people who fell into the sea, but frankly, I think the dolphins are so smart that I prefer to believe the story about that they were the memorizers.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at the skeleton of a dolphin, of course, they have hip bones, they have a pelvis, they feed their babies with breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at their fins and their tail, that it's actually the skeleton of two legs, and there are actually five phalange finger bones in each of the fins. And so, you know, they must have been land-oriented at one time, and the only reason to have five fingers is to manipulate, to use hands. And everyone should take a look at the skeleton of a dolphin. They're in the books. It's quite remarkable. Well, the story finishes up by saying there were those who survived by going into the sea. They were the memorizers, our ancient ones. And then others who managed to survive by coming to the western edge of this continent, and that they could live in abundance and in peace and in harmony as long as they kept the laws of living within the code of nature, then they would survive and they would be comfortable. But they were warned, and this is what Kotlota said at this point, he said that they were warned that there might come again the people of the mind, and that they would approach them from east of our continent, and that if they got a foothold, then there would be no stopping them until they had pushed the people of the heart to the western edge of this land. And when the people of the heart, they were of many colors and cultures, found themselves with their backs against when they could be pushed no further, an amazing thing would happen. They would begin to turn around, recognize each other, and remember. And from this recognition at the western edge of this continent, the remembering, the turning around, they would create a great wave of the heart that would move across from the western edge of this continent to the and then around the whole world, restoring harmony and balance.
Well, it certainly looks like it's coming true, because when you think about the fulfillment of the, when the Hopi prophecy began to be fulfilled, when the young people, the grandchildren of, from and the great-grandchildren of the ones who fought at Greasy Grass, the Custer fight, fulfillment of prophecy, the hippie movement, you know, which became the New Age movement, and which has become so many things, but these people, well, Grandfather Rolling Thunder called them the reincarnates, and I see that these people are much more seem to be much more accepting of what's being taught than the Native people today. It seems like the young Native people today tend to get involved with the struggle and they go join AIM and they're just and it's really funny. They didn't live through most of them didn't live through the boarding school years, and you know, they weren't beaten by their teachers, but even though they didn't go through those experiences, they've internalized that anger, which I think is really interesting. And
well, it's much easier to criticize and condemn than it is to build, you know, and create.
Sure is.
But the elders aren't like that.
No, they aren't. They really are.
It was a terrible thing that happened to them, when the children were forcibly removed from their families and their culture and raised in these penal institutions, not allowed to speak their language, put in ill-fitting clothes, and treated like they were dirty and something was wrong with them.
I know
what... There's a generation that reclaimed those. There are those among the white societies that started going back to Celtic traditions and the Druid schools and Margitic and Buddhist, and talking about the goddess times of the Aquarian culture and living with the earth, and people going back into rediscovering the Egyptian, the Mayan, the Incan, the Zoroastrian, the Kabbalah, Hindu, Sufi. It was just so exciting. I was just the right age. I was in my teens in the 50s, and in the 60s I was in my 20s and emancipated, and I was in the middle of it, and it was extraordinary that anything that lasted really such a short time was so huge. It was like the very air crackled with an electricity of love and celebration. Tremendous.
Isn't that something?
Did you want me to talk about the Hopi pen?
Please, yeah, absolutely.
And then you've got it on your website as well?
I've got the Hopi Ted and the Uncle John both. They're very important.
Well, I would really like to give it right now myself, because people have already, with the stories of the blanket of hope, the Hopi Ted, people must realize that the oral tradition is sacred, absolutely inviolate. The words that the elders use are extraordinary. They usually seem very simple and elemental. I am still learning from this list of 10 things that the Hopi told me. What I first thought they were talking about, I realized when I committed them to memory and then wrote them down, stuck it on my refrigerator, on my medicine cabinet wall, just looked at them over and over again, that there are dimensions and levels to each thing they say, and so it must not be changed. And I look on the internet these days, there are a few places where people have taken my words. We also had them Xeroxed and passed a lot of them out, and they have reproduced them on the internet as they were given, and yet I'm very disappointed. In many places I find that the wording has been changed, and in doing so it's simply not as clear. It's confusing. People will take the elders' words, like whatever it was that was in the Bible, and tend to use them for their own agendas. And it's terribly important within an oral tradition, and I will speak especially for the Native American, when you get something that comes out of the elders and the traditionalists, you must, and souls and committed to memory to not take a license with it, because you're cheating yourself of the learning curve that it creates. So anyway, that's my little, what do you call that thing you stick in the front? Disclaimer.
Oh, yeah, your preamble. But this is absolutely true, because people of the book don't know how it works with traditional people. They don't understand that the traditional people have memorized everything. These things have been passed down for thousands of years, and every word is weighed and calculated to have its effect.
Yes, right. Well, what I'll do is I'll quickly tell you how the Hopi Dance came about. In 1993, I was living in Northern California, and it was a terrible, terrible time among Indian communities. There was a group that called themselves, Center for Spirit. That's right.
Right.
And like the moral majority, it was neither. I don't know who these people, I could name a name, but I don't know, maybe I'll just leave it at that.
All right.
Attacking all Native peoples who were sharing knowledge of the Native American way, the earth knowledge. Well, as Thomas Manyakya said, this is critical, that this knowledge needs to be shared. It must be shared.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony, so it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
Hasn't been shared, that we're in such a mess. And he said, on this turtle island, at this time, by the time of the day of the time of purification comes, there will be people from all the directions who will found themselves here. People from the east, people from the south, people from the north, Europeans, Asians, Africans, all the peoples. Will find themselves here on Turtle Island, and they will bring their knowledge, their portion of the truth that was given by Masao, and people will gravitate toward it. They'll want to hear it and learn it, practice it. The last piece that will be offered and will be the most difficult there will be a great struggle around it, and that will be the knowledge of the people of the West. That is the American continent. People are so used to calling Western culture, Western thought, and that naming Europeans that way. Well, they're the people of the North. There was a whole continent to the west of them that they didn't seem to include or acknowledge. So here, this earth knowledge, this ahomitakwiasin for all of our relations, living in right relation with the earth in the sacred manner, the kind of things that come out of the Native American culture is the last, and that's the Native culture of Turtle Island, and it is the last that will be listened to. But if all the truth of the four directions are come here, and the sacred hoop is mended on Turtle Island, then we will have the peace and the prosperity and all that is prophesied about the fifth world. Well, there was this group, and they took on the mantle of Native American, and what they did was attack anyone who was sharing Native American wisdom, Earth people's knowledge. And to the point where there were threats on people's life, there were just terrible things. There were letters sent out to discredit the people, libel and slander all over the place.
Still going on.
And attacks, that's right, it is still going on. I'm very suspicious of that group, because any true Native American group that's working in the light and the truth never has hardly any money to work from. They're always struggling. But I understand that there was several name clone groups that seemed to have plenty of shiny jackets and walkie-talkies and cell phones and all kinds of equipment and stuff in this Center for Spirit that also called itself the Bay Area Indian Community, and there was none. There's no such thing, not as far as an organized group is concerned. It never had an address, it never had a phone number, it had a post office box. And they sent out all kinds of letters and denouncing these Indian elders and casting doubts on them. And so many people, non-Indian organizations, stopped sponsoring these elders and these various teachers. They were afraid because they didn't want to be politically incorrect or making a mistake, or they were afraid of being bombed, and there were those threats that were made. So all of the venues that made it possible for us to talk to the people of other colors and other cultures were closed down to us by people purporting to be of our own blood. And that was very, very serious. And there was just paranoia and fear, and it was very ugly. It made all Indian people look bad and confused everyone else. So one day I got on the phone and I called Thomas Banyakya, and he's almost never home this day. He answered himself. And I told him, I said, please help me remember. There are many people who are saying I shouldn't be telling these stories or teaching these spirit tools. And so I want to ask you, do you remember when I was with you, and it was over 30 years ago? He said, yes, I remember very well. And I said, the story of the Hopi prophecy and the different things that you told me, did you tell me those things just for myself alone? Were they a secret? Or I was under the impression that everyone could gain great value by learning these things, and that you wanted people to be told, and that's why you told me. And he said, yes, that's right. Well, I just heaved a great sigh, because I had begun to think that I was getting this flack because I was doing something that I wasn't supposed to, and I'd gotten it mixed up in 30-some years. And so he said, yes, you are right. He said, we did give this to you to share with others who we hoped would then share it with others. And he said, the elders will want to speak to you. And he said, can you come now? And I was going to school. I'd gone back to school at the time. And And then I realized this was right at the beginning of the Easter break. And I said, yes, I can leave tomorrow. And he said, good, the elders will want to meet with you. So the next day I drove, it's exactly 1,000 miles from Highway 101 to Third Mesa and Door Riding, where Thomas lives. And so then I went to his house, and I stayed there for several days, and the elders didn't come, and he didn't come, and I was getting, it was getting to be about time where I was going to have to go back home. And then the daughter, the oldest daughter of Chief Mina Lanxa, John Lanxa, came to me, and she said, the elders will not come to you while you're here. I was confused by that. I didn't understand what she meant. She said, so pack your clothes, take up your things, and I will take you to a riding.
Ah.
So I went with her to her mother's house. Of course, Mina and John have now passed on, and the house was passed on to her and her son. And I did what I had done 30 years before, which was I pulled up in front of the house, and I slept that night in my station wagon. And at dawn the next morning, I woke up with a start. And just as the light was coming on to Arrive in the dance grounds, there was a great ladder coming out of the Kiva. And they ask you to please not take pictures there. And so I never have. But I was so disappointed that 30 years later, and I had come back to Hopi, and that the elders never came, and there was no wisdom that came with my name there. And so I thought, well, I will probably, I have no reason to ever return again. I just want to take a couple of pictures of this sunrise and the tops of the buildings and the ladder. So I took out my little camera, and I'm standing there, kind of shielding it behind the open door of the car. And just as I'm about to take a picture, I hear the shuffling, and I look, and they're coming down the road between the houses is a group of elders. And one man was a little bit younger, but these were old, old men. And they didn't seem to notice me, and they kind of shuffled past me, and they gathered in a semicircle on the dance grounds on the roof of the Kiva. And then there was the oldest man facing them with a younger man kind of supporting him at his elbow. And he began talking, and I just didn't move. I dropped the camera and just stayed right where I was. And he said, you have been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go and tell them it is the hour, and there are things to be considered. And then I realized, telling the people this is the 11th hour. Well, that's me. I had called the workshops I'd done for many years, 20 years, 11th hour tools for spiritual warriors in a hurry. And now he was saying I couldn't call it that anymore. And I realized, though he was not looking at me, he was looking at the other elders in the semicircle. But I could hear him clearly, and he didn't look at me during this time, and that's when he said, this is the hour, and there are things to be considered. Now, I'm going to do the 10 as I heard them, and then I would like to go over them. Maybe we could discuss each one in its multiple meanings. But the very basic words were this: where do you live? What are you doing? Are you in right relation? What are your relationships? Where is your water? Know your garden. It is time to speak your truth. Create your communities. Be good to each other. Do not look outside yourself for the leader. And then he brought his hands together in a great like clap, and he said, and this could be a good time.
That's amazing.
And as they were leaving, then they started, you know, I kind of waited holding my breath and thinking that then he was going to turn to me, because at that point I felt sure he had meant them for me, those words. But they just started to shuffle now on the other side of the road, going on the other side of the Monks' house. And I realized that this was my moment. These were the elders. And I needed to ask them a question about all the slack I was getting along with all the other teachers. And so I kind of walked very fast, and they didn't even stop. And I was walking alongside of the elder who was doing the speaking. And I said, and they didn't look familiar. I mostly just knew Dan Kachanga, Thomas, and Fumina Banyagya, David Norman Ongie, and did I name everybody? Yeah. And that's pretty much who I knew. So these elders, and I think they're all, those people are all past now, and these elders were every bit as old as the others seemed to be, but I said, oh, please excuse me. And he kept on walking slowly. I said, I sort of started to just blither out, talking as fast as I could because they weren't pausing. And I said something about, you know, there's an organization and some folks out there that are trying to stop Native people from sharing the knowledge in this world is having so much trouble. And I said, do you remember, and I said my name, but before I received my Indian name, I had another name, and I said my name, and I said, do you remember when I was here before, or something like that. Anyway, he surprised me by saying, do you remember when you were here before? And I was stunned that he would remember, because I don't remember meeting him, but he said, do you remember when you were here before? And I said, am I doing the right thing? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, do you remember when you were here before? And he said, we taught you that as you go through life, you must remember three things. And I sort of nodded. But I kind of panicked for a moment because they were always teaching me things in groups of three. And then I just sort of went, nodded my head and hoped that he wasn't going to test me because I wasn't sure which group he was talking about. And then he said, the first one was, he said, you must ask permission. Oh, he said, what are they? And I just jumped on this one that I remember. I was in the car with Thomas Minyaka, David Marangi, and John Monksa, and I was taking them up, I think, to Walpi, and I was getting very nervous because I always thought of myself as having been raised in a polite family and conscious of other people's feelings and etiquette and so forth. But there is something in the traditional Native people's household that it's so subtle, so exquisite. It's an etiquette that made me feel like a bull in the china shop.
Yeah.
And they were taking me from traditional household to traditional household. And the people seemed to be very poor, and I wasn't sure if they had much, you know, food for themselves. And they would always bring me food to eat. And I was totally confused of should I refuse it or just take a few bites so as not to take their food, or I just was going berserk. And they asked me to pull over the road I was driving. And they said, look, there are three things that you must remember. First of all, you ask permission. Oh, no. First of all, wake up. Be aware. Second of all, ask permission. And the third one is, then it's up to you. So he said, yes, well, now it's up to you. And what that said to me is that they had found that I had asked permission. I was awake and aware. And now if I wanted to continue teaching and get shit, it was up to me. They were going to go there with neon signs and banners and saying, you know, leave Chikosha Ho'o alone. She's one of ours. We have permission. She's doing our work. You know, be nice to her. They weren't going to do that.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of WiseFoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfasts and 10 delicious dinner entrees from WiseFoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year supply from WiseFoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingraham, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why?
But that, you know, because I'd been aware and had asked permission and had this knowledge now, if I wanted to stick my neck out for whatever would happen, well, it was up to me. So this is what they said. Okay. All right, let's talk about the first one. Where do you live? What do you think about that one?
Well, I know where I live. I don't,
Let me give you a hint. It's more than geographical. Where do you live?
Well, you can live... do you live in your head or do you live in your heart?
Yeah, right. Where do you spend your time, your thoughts? Where are you investing your life? Where do you live? And what is it that gives you life? What's your passion? What's your love? And I think it also says that we need to choose wisely now where we live as well. And then the second one was, what are you doing? So if we're the ones we've been waiting for, what are we doing? You can leave in here any time.
Well, you know, the prophecies say that at this time, there'd be so many people that they really wouldn't know what to do. And they said a lot of people would finally figure it out, but it would be too late to do anything about it. And so that's why I've been doing what I've doing for these years. And Yeah, and yeah, I was given, and I can look back now and I can see, well, I can see how I was raised. I was raised to be by articulate white people, and then turned back over to Native people, which is part of my heritage. But I, you know, my dad was a professional engineer, and he prided himself. He said, "I can communicate with anybody." He said, "Whether it's the guy in the shop, you know, with the wrench, or the president of the company." And he told me, he says, "That's what you need to do. You need to be able to communicate with anybody. Don't be above anybody, but don't be below anybody." So that's I can see I was prepared to do what I'm doing, but I just have had such a sense of urgency because time is so short. So that's why you've been doing it for what, 40 years, and you know I've been doing it basically for about 15 years, and when you close your eyes, I'll be doing it for a while, and hopefully someone will come up behind me. But time really is short.
We've got to do it now. That's it. Okay, here's one that you probably know. Are you in right relation?
Well, that's
what I understand that to be is being in right relation, living your life in right relation, is your relationship to everything, to nature, to your children, to are you a consumer? Are you one of the people that buy a product which is essentially unsafe for the planet, and so giving it a market and encouraging then these different materials that are toxic to be, increased? Do you ever get on a bicycle or walk? Are you part of the problem or part of the solution? Are you in right relation? Are you living in balance? And then the one that follows that is the one that I'm still a little unsure of, whether they said who or what are your relationships. What are your relationships? Each one of these is like a cone, to be meditated on. And then it says, where is your water? Well, I took that, especially because this was prior to Y2K, where everything is run by computer chips, and things were warned that it might all stop. And so if you go to turn on the faucet and no water comes out of your faucet, or your bathtub, what are you going to do?
Uh-huh.
Do you know where your water is? Because that's going to be the first thing to be controlled, and also the first thing to be sabotaged and to go.
Absolutely.
So where is your water? When I was living in Topanga Canyon, there was a group that took the possibility of Y2K quite seriously. We thought, well, we don't know if it's going to happen or not, but what can we do to prepare? And what I did was try to find all of the old springs and the water sources before they had public water that came in. People had wells, and there were springs. Well, they're still all over the place. And then, I love this one, know your garden.
You know, it takes years to know a garden.
Yeah, well, I think they're talking about more than just what you've got in the fence line in your backyard. And more than just the domestic garden in your house. I think that it's this planet is a garden. It's the garden. One of the things that I do is I take people out and I teach them how to identify medicinal and edible plants, the wild native plants, and how to pick them in a sacred manner so that you're cultivating the wild, so you're encouraging growth rather than wiping out an area. And And it's a beautiful experience. It's very conscious, and it's very easy to learn these things, and the wild things are still growing all around us. Well, anyway, they said, know your garden. And some of the most important medicinal and edible so-called weeds are growing in vacant lots and between the cracks and sidewalks and any place that hasn't been concreted over. Those wonderful green people just keep pushing themselves up for our benefit. So know your garden. So we've got, where do you live? What are you doing? Are you in right relation? What are your relationships? Where is your water? Know your garden. And then moves into, it is time to speak your truth. The Hopis told me that at the moment of birth, when the new being takes its first breath, when the baby takes its first breath, that's the beginning of its lifetime. And it ends with the last breath. So between those two breaths is your lifetime. Well, when that baby takes its first breath, the Hopis believe that at that moment of birth, the great mystery places in each and every one of us a sacred truth and a special strength. And that it's then up to us to define that truth, refine it, and give it back to the people. We used to have elders that through their witnessing and observation would help us. Now it's mostly up to us. But then here's the part that helps that part. It is time to create your community. It's critical. The elders say that the time of, oh, Uncle John said this as well, the time of the lone wolf is over. We must gather ourselves.
Absolutely. And you know, that's really hard. My family's involved with a group here in Missouri, and it's hard to come together as a small community because people are used to living all over the place and you know making, you know, you meet together once a week but it's mind-boggling to think, you know, what would happen if the electricity went off tomorrow, you know. And the thing that I've said to these folks is, well, you know, hey, everybody's on well systems, and you know, our wells are at least 100 feet deep. And I said the first problem we're going to have is pumping water,
and you can't rely on the electricity.
No.
From the grid.
And so you know we've you know some of us are more affluent than others, and you know what. When you have a group of five or six families, and then you begin to think, well, you know, some of us have a, you know, a wind charger, or you know, it's a or generators or whatever would be needed to create alternating current, and at least we could pump water, you know, for several minutes a day, you know, if it's enough to just, you know, keep you alive. And it takes coming together as a community, especially food production, those kind of things, it's really mind-boggling. So I always tell people, well, you know, you talked about know your garden, and I tell people, well, when they ask me, well, what am I going to do about food? I said, when I lived in Utah some years ago, I picked up a book that was called How to Survive a Famine. And the book had the outline of that Biafra child on the front of it. It was a black book and with a pink outline of this, pink silhouette of this child. And basically the book was full of, it was by region, and it explained what weeds in what regions are edible, so you didn't get a hold of something that would kill you. And they said that any weed is edible and tastes really good, provided you have maybe some vegetable oil to cook it in. and it'll keep you alive. And it said that, you know, even grass, you know, and they said people will starve to death in the future, and there'll be tons of food around for them to eat. They just won't know how.
That's right. We're here because our ancestors, before there were supermarkets, we got this far because our ancestors knew the foods and knew the medicines that just grew wild. And, you know, especially here in the United States, it's just a big breadbasket. Well, you know, it's more than just for a physical survival. Well, I guess it's all connected. If you are alone, there are so many lies that we are being given at this time, that if you don't have people to talk your thoughts over with, you'll feel like you're going crazy, because it seems like the whole rest of the world is all doing this one thing, and there's something inside of your being that's screaming, no, no, no. And so it's very important, number 7, when it says it's time to speak your truth, we really have to not hide ourselves who we are in order to get along, because then nobody will know who we really are. So at this time, it is critical to speak our truth. And then others like us can find us. We can be identified there.
That's right.
And then we'll feel stronger. If there's someone else that you can speak the unspeakable to, the thing that you were afraid to share, and they go, oh, I'm so glad you said that, I feel the same way, then your whole being just takes this great breath, and you go, oh, all right, I'm all right. You know, and it gives you strength. The lone wolves, we are of an ilk, and we can all be lone wolves together. You know, we don't have to change our nature, but we do need to be around others like our soul, the colors of our soul, not our skin. And so it's time to speak your truth, and then it said from that, create your communities. Maybe just people that you can celebrate with, that you can tell, and a community can be very small. And then number 9 is be good to each other. Now, I have to share with you what happened to this Hopi elder's body when he said this one. Now, he'd been very serious, his two hands out. But then when he said be good to each other, he kind of raised up on his heels, or on his toes a bit, and just kind of sparkled. He said, be good to each other. And what I got from his energy and the way he said it and the way his body just kind of became so concentrated, and it was so cute, frankly, I saw him sparkle. And it was like, be good to each other, create a community, and make it be the game, the art of being good to each other. You know, with intention, doing things that bring smiles to each other's eyes. Little surprises, little who knows what. You know, be creative with this. And in this group, and even sometimes with strangers, what can you do that is a gift of the moment, that is a connection in this very isolated culture that we experience? Being good to each other.
You know, the one thing that I've found that our little group here, basically we're 6 families, and there's some other families that are allied with us. But as we've gone through the process, I've noticed that the biggest struggle that each family had was that families tend to be like lone wolves themselves. And it's easy for a family to say, well, I'm going to share this with my kids, or I'm making plans for my kids to come, but on the other hand, you know, I look at them and tell them, you know, hey, your children are probably the last people that are going to come. Yes, we can hope and pray that they'll come, but the ones that are here now are getting ready are the ones that need each other the worst. And this has been the energy block, the dynamic that needs to be broken through. People need to recognize that you can be a lone wolf unto yourself, but you can also be lone wolves in your own family, because each family is a unit. So as you go through your dynamics in this next a year, and find your people and treat them like your family, or better than your family. Identify who it is that are going to be your allies, and treat them like family, because your own family may not come.
Yes, it's true, isn't it? But we need to find people that we can share our fears and our joys with, that you can talk about things, to discuss what we're being fed in the newspapers, through the media, what's going on, and to share our dark place with, and people that know how to treat each other with honor and respect.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
Have you ever read or made available to them the Hopi 10?
Oh, yes. The Hopi 10 have been in my encyclopedia with attribution to you for quite some time now. They've been up on the websites about a year and a half, something like that.
But this group of six families?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, good.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Well, that kind of depersonalizes it. That's another thing that Uncle John said. God bless him. I hope he tries to get in touch with me. I have no idea where he is. I think I'm making him famous.
How old was he when you knew him in the 70s?
Oh, I actually met him in the 80s. That would have been around 83, 84.
20 years ago. How old was he then?
Well, of course, now that I'm in my 60s and I feel like a kid, he seems so old to me. I can't really tell people's ages anymore. But
you think he might have been in his 70s?
60s, 70s, yeah.
Yeah, if it was John Fadden, I think he's walked west.
Nice looking man.
Yeah, John, I believe it was, I don't know. It's just hard to know who that was.
The only thing I know about him is that at the time he was living in the Kern River, eastern part of mid-California. But anyway, here's another goodie that he said. I'm sure that I was struggling with something and shared it with him, and he said to me, it is imperative that you tell your people, that at this time in the world's history, they are not to take anything personally, least of all of themselves. Because the moment that you do, your spiritual growth and journey comes to a screeching halt.
Not to take yourself seriously?
Personally.
Oh, personally.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And we're all here right now to do a job. Don't personalize it. Don't get into a big thing of it. Just take care of business.
Oh, well, the philosophy of my teacher, John Red Hat. John was adopted into Chief Mike's, Chief O'Reilly's family. Chief Mike was John Lance's brother. And John's attitude was, hey, you know, it's just a job. You know, being an elder is just a job. It's nothing special. You know, everybody's got their functions. And he says, it's just something you got to do. And he says, don't let it go to your head. And he says, run. He says, if you get around somebody that thinks they're somebody, he says, run from them. You know, and that's always, I've always thought that way, you know.
I remember Raymond Stone, the Paiute elder, that wonderful man. And people, you know, started to put him up on a big pedestal and idolize him. And he was written about in several books, and they were starting to make a big to-do about him, and he would love to just turn around, look him straight in the eye, and say, I'm just an old fart doing his job.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I've heard others say, you know, just watch the movie and take care of your business. By the way, that suddenly reminds me of something that my Chumash elder, Grandfather Victor Lopez, said. He said, you know, when it comes, and I want to say this to the people, I know in the 60s, 70s, 80s, a lot of folks who didn't look very much like an American Indian were wearing headbands and beads and feathers and all that stuff, or, you know, non-Indian people in the sweat lodges. Of course, if your family's been in the United States very long, you probably got some Indian blood in there anyway, but it's just a matter of spirit. You know, where do you live? Not blood or color. And you know, I would ask him, when I would see all the discord and people, you know, wanting to know, well, what's your percentage of your Indian, or what are you doing in here? You've got blue eyes, or I would just hear people being treated very badly like that. And so I asked him about that, and he said to me, he said, when it comes to your spirit way, he said, what you must do is do whatever you do with honor and respect. And if you do that, then it's between you and your creator, and it isn't anybody else's business.
Honor.
I just love that.
Honor is, you know, people basically understand respect. But honor is another thing. I know when my first wife, after she passed away and I remarried, within 6 months she came back, and I see her quite often. Whenever something's going to happen that might shake me up, will always let me know something's going to happen. Anyway, she showed up and told Betty something. And she said, she says, if you don't raise Joseph, that was her son and my son. And she says, if you don't raise Joseph with honor, he'll be taken away from you and given to somebody else. And don't you think that didn't shake us up? Well, you know, honor, you know, you can't look that up in the encyclopedia. There's a little bit of a picture of what it is in the dictionary. But you have to go to organizations like the, you know, Wyandian Guides or the Boy Scouts and those kind of people. They're the only ones that really deal in those kind of terms, you know. And the biggest problem I see there's a lot of people running around that have big holes in their hearts, and they grab a hold of native culture, but even for whatever reason, they've got some native blood or they become enamored with it, and before they internalize it, they just say, oh, well, I'm an Indian, and then they don't change their ways. They still think like the old person, and so it's the same kind of process, I guess, that any spiritual organization asks you to go through, and that is, you know, people need to learn what honor really is, and not deny those things which are honest and truthful, and embrace them. It's just, you know, we live in a culture that just doesn't teach those values very readily, which is really a shame.
Yeah, I agree with you on a level, and sometimes that really used to turn me off, you know, but then after my elder, and it was that kind of angst that I had, like many other Native people around that, you know, the kind of annoying, presumption, but posturing. And so that's when I asked Victor Lopez, one of the most loving people and wisest that I've ever, his wisdom came from love. And there wasn't a whole lot of that going around in the Indian community at the time. Everybody was trying to figure out how to be Indian, you know, because there'd been such a breaking of the lineage. And we did talk further about it, and I said the same thing that you said about these people who come in posturing and without changing their lot, you know, their ways. But, you know, he said, well, think of this. They could have been drawn, something in their souls drew them to what is the wisdom of the earth people's knowledge here. And he said, so maybe they're just jumping around, making a lot of noise and wearing feathers and beads. But who knows? Everyone enters this at their own pace, in their own level. And maybe by doing this, so he comes, or she comes to a Sundance or a sweat lodge or a powwow, and they wear all these things, but then they're brought into this. And they're exposed to it. And maybe through time, though, they entered in a superficial way, it speaks to them and they begin to grow up.
That's right.
They go deeper. Well, and he said, besides, it's not our business anyway. If they do what they do with honor and respect, you know, Creator will take care of them.
That's right. And people need, my wife has a direct female lineage back to her clan. She's one of the few Cherokees that knows what clan she comes from. But one of her her famous sayings is, "Hey, you have two holes to listen with, and one to make noise with." So, Creator obviously wants us to listen twice as much as to talk. That's good advice.
Yes, it is. And I remember something that Twilineage Uinoja Cherokee or Seneca elder said to me, you know, when you're pointing your finger at somebody else, look at you, do that with your hand. And so I did that.
You got three pointing back at you.
Exactly. Those are great. You know, that's really wonderful. And there you are. It's the truth.
Well, let's see. Have you covered the 10 yet, or were you on 9?
No, we did. Oh, that's right. Okay, be good to each other. Oh, we did 9. Be good to each other, he said. And 10. And do not look outside yourself for the leader.
Absolutely. You know, and you know what? This is what I've talked about. This is what Red Elk talks about. You know, and this is what people really laugh at us for talking about, you know, is that, and it's a completely foreign concept to a lot of people, that we should not even look beyond ourselves Well, one of my favorite stories is and I talk a lot about the Bible and everything because I was brought up in that tradition, and I use those teachings from the Bible to try to point out some of the realities rather than what people believe is the dogma. And I said, you know, when Moses went up the mountain, I said, all the people were invited to go up. And they said, no, Moses, you go on up. And the first time he came down, he came down with a set of laws, and, he saw that, the people were not going to be able to live those laws, and he broke those laws, and he went back up and got another law. And those laws that those people have been living for these, many thousands of years, a very difficult law. But if they had gone up the mountain with him the first time, we never would have had the priests between us. We never would have needed anyone between us and our Creator. Right, Jesus said, my sheep know my voice. And, he also said, if you come to me, and if I never knew you, I'm going to say I never knew you. So now's the time to establish a direct relationship with whatever your concept of your God is. Because if you talk, rather than talking at it, if you talk with it, they will, your Creator will begin to establish a contact with you and will help protect you. And when people ask me, well, should we move out of the cities and how close is it getting? And I say, hey, don't worry about it. The thing you need to worry about is, are you going to be fearful when this happens? Because I said, if you have the voice of the Creator and access to it, you're never going to worry about anything. Because you're going to know for a certainty that before it happens, you're going to know what's going to happen. And, so I look at my Christian friends and say, hey, you remember when the two people were going around the camp of Israel and the people went to Moses complaining? And Moses kind of said, well, so what? He says, I would that everyone could be a prophet. So this is the natural order of things is to be your own prophet, to be your own priest, and to be your own king. And I think that's what we're finally coming around to as we get ready to go with Mother Earth into these changes. And it can be easy or it can be hard, depending on how we react to it.
Absolutely. I guess I'm wanting to kind of maybe close this evening with two things. One is that I think that where religions went wrong is they got fixated on the messenger. And because what instead of the source, and the truth and the message that the messenger was carrying, they made a cult around the messenger instead of keeping their eyes on the sun or their focus on the source, the Creator, in whatever language you want to say, that is all around and is in everything. And so by fixating on the messengers instead of fixating on the message, that created all these divisions, and my messenger's better than your messenger, and it's just terribly sad because nobody's paying attention to what they said. And they did. They created a cult around the messenger. But about this death business, in 1988, from 1985 to 88, there were a couple of attempts on my life because I was considered one of the leaders of the protest against the canonization of Nebro Sarah. And apparently one of the attempts, or two of them, I believe, I wasn't even aware of until afterwards. But this one, on January the 17th at 6 o'clock in the morning, 1988, I guess, my friend Anna Mary Brown was driving me through the rain from Pacific Grove, California, to San Francisco at the Unitarian Church in Franklin and Erie. And it was a colloquium of mainstream ministers, like Episcopalian, Lutheran, Methodist, Protestant, those groups, Unitarian. I'm not sure if Unity was involved, but those ministers coming from all over the United States to talk about spirituality and the environmental ethic. And I was asked to do the opening talk. Well, we never made it, because about 20 minutes from home, driving on pretty much a deserted 101 highway, the rain wasn't that bad, and all of a sudden we were struck by a vehicle from behind us, struck so hard it turned our car into what seemed like an accordion fleet.
Oh, see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Hi, this is Will Bluehour speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony, so it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
And my friend who was driving was killed instantly. And when we were found by the Aromas Fire Department rescue crew, they had checked both of our vital signs and neither one of us were showing anything. So as far as they were concerned, I was also dead. But let me tell you what my experience was. One minute, I was looking at her hands, and then I guess we were struck. I don't remember the crash at all. I had been told just a week before by someone, and they said to me, you know, when you die, like if it's an accident or something horrific, like an explosion or so forth, your soul leaves your body just before it happens. And I went, oh, okay, and kind of forgot about it. Well, this is what I experienced. One minute, I turned around and looked at her hands, and then without skipping a beat, the next thing I knew, we were having a conversation out of the car, walking down the highway 101, walking south. And I looked, and I was caught, you know, it's dark in January at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's pitch dark. But I noticed that the shrubs that were on either side of the highway seemed to have kind of like an amber glow around them. And that I was trying to keep up with her. She seemed to be very determined. She knew exactly where she was going. And I was just trying to keep up with her because I remember remarking to myself, this is the most interesting conversation I have ever had with anybody in my whole life. And so I kept, you know, keeping up with her going south through the darkness. And then a light came off to my right, and with it a buzzing sound, and then I pushed it away. out of my consciousness and then had to catch up with her again. This happened 3 times, and each time the buzzing sound and the light became stronger. And on the 3rd time, I saw that I was like in 2 different worlds. There was my friend as I watched her walking away in the distance going south, and then there was me trying to deal with this buzzing sound and this light. And pretty soon, the buzzing sound and the light became more real, and she kind of faded off into the distance. And the buzzing sound, eventually I was able to make out that they were words, and the light was a flashlight. There's no light at the end of the tunnel here. And they were brushing, you know, calling my name. It turned out that the rescue worker, Pete McCusick, the one that was there in the car with me and trying to, you know, brush the glass off me and so forth, had been himself in a sweat lodge the night before, and the people there had been asked to pray on me, for me, on my behalf. So he knew who I was. And then as I came out of it, I realized that my friend had slumped over and was lying across my lap, and her head was facing towards the dashboard, and I had my right hand under her right cheek, and my left hand was on top of her head, kind of just cradling her head between my hands. And they told me later on that they had not, in quite a while, that they had not been able to find any vital signs on me, and that my friend had been killed instantly. Her heart had ruptured. It literally exploded by the impact behind it. What I experienced, and is real today as this moment that I'm speaking to you, is that there, Uncle John again, he said, you know, there is no death. There is only life. Life in the body, life without it. And that my experience, and I know this is true now, that there is no death. When what we call death comes, we simply drop this overcoat that we've been given. And there is untouched, unblemished, and as personal as before, our being. I still felt like Tukosh. If you had told me I didn't have a body, I wasn't in my body at that moment, I wouldn't have been able to relate to that at all. In my body and out of my body, I felt exactly precisely the same. And the difference wasn't so much as a winking of an eye. And we are this spiritual being having this human experience. And when we drop the overcoat, when we step out of the body, it isn't even a hiccup, and we just continue on. The mystery, the miracle of conscious life is so much bigger than what the body can hold. And this I know for sure.
Well, that's a good place to let folks think about what they've heard tonight. We sure appreciate you being on Prophecy Keepers as our guest tonight. And
well, it is such a great pleasure. It makes my blood pump. It's where I live. In sharing these things, you know, it's just. It's where I live.
This is Yasa Sago, a 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous plant-based native sacraments. Aho.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Thank you.